I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm his co-host, Greg Lindsay. Our guest this week is Andrew Schenken, professor of architecture at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the newish book, The Everyday Life of Memorials, which, as he notes in the introduction, of course, this is not about memorials as we know them in the recent context, of course, of Black Lives Matter or the Confederate memorials or May Day or other types of protests and activations, nor is it like Memorial Day and other ceremonials. This is about the times where, as he describes it, memorials are turned off as opposed to turned on, which is a nomenclature I love, this idea that they toggle in terms of memory back and forth and meaning for us. But Andrew's written about sort of their existence as just simply part of urbanism, how they frame parks and how they frame streets and shading and seating and all the ways in which they actually contribute to the urban framework. And just even reading the book, I thought about all the various monuments and memorials I've intersected with, and also discussions of cemeteries and graveyards, Greenwood Cemetery in New York, of course, maybe being the most famous example of one that was Central Park before Central Park, or when I was wandering New England graveyards this fall. And so it's a real pleasure to have Andy on here to talk about this sort of really neglected piece of the urban fabric, these memorials, when they are simply minding their own business, so to speak. So Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
I guess the obvious question is ask if you quickly frame again sort of the context and meanings of the book for you. And this is something you've been working on for a very long time. You mentioned in the intro that you started thinking about this in 2006. And so I'm curious the gestation and the germ of the idea and how that sort of has manifested for you, particularly given how they became this really, I mean, not unprecedented, but really once in a generation, many generations, sites of contestation around Confederate memorials and whatnot. And yeah, how do you think we'll see memorials going forward?
Well, those are two really different questions, how I came to the topic and what's going to happen with them. How I came to the topic...
That's what happens when Unfrozen, Andy. We just throw questions out there and you'll have to sort them out.
That's good. I'll try to stay lively. So the first part of the question, really, it goes back a long way. I think when I first got to graduate school, memorials were not on my radar. In fact, they might have been the opposite of being on my radar. I ignored them like a lot of people, and I more or less was, I don't want to say a victim, but I was somebody who very much fell in line with Robert Musil's famous idea that nothing is more invisible than a monument. To me, they were invisible. They meant nothing to me. And I think part of that is generational. Somebody who, say, fought in a war might pay greater heed to memorials. But I'm part of the Generation X that did not fight in a war, and they felt distant to me. And other types of monuments and memorials also were part of a memory industry that I wasn't part of. So they were incidental and in the way, if anything, but probably they were just not there for me. And I stumbled upon a topic when I was in graduate school that sort of awakened them to me, or awakened me to them, really, and I started noticing them. And at first, I think I treated them the way an art historian would treat them. I thought of them formally, I thought of them spatially, I thought of them as artistic works, I thought of them historically, and none of that felt very interesting to me. But I kept looking at them and something kept bothering me about them, and it took me years, way too many years for me to feel good about myself, to figure out that a lot of stuff was going on that is not about necessarily their artistry or about their formal qualities or even, although I had spent a lot of time in the book looking at where they are, even about that, but rather about all the different forces that they're part of, the maelstrom of urbanism that surrounds them and that they're part of, that sometimes they partake in and sometimes they take their distance from. And so finally, when I got around to writing this, rewriting the book, because it was something that I began writing years ago, I was a different thinker, a different person, and I was awake to them in a new way. And I was really interested in, as you said in your really lovely introduction, how they move between different states, states of being turned on and states of being turned off. So I'm interested in both those states. I'm not trying to ignore their political power or their commemorative value, but rather I'm interested in how they flip between these different states and what that means. And it's an urban story, as you note. Where are they going?
This is the question.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, I just to build upon that question for a second, because what are the most successful urban monuments as urban pieces of furniture? And yeah, where are they going? Because in the United States, I would argue, perhaps we're still in like the post-Myelin generation, or like the Vietnam War Memorial is the success. And all the ones in D.C. have, you know, either been misfires or, I mean, the whole Gary, you know, memorial, I believe, for Eisenhower, of course, became a fiasco. And so, yeah, what is the concept of success? And how do we start to rethink our relationship to them to really bring them back into the urban fabric beyond the perhaps accidental successes?
Yeah, I think that this could be a really controversial question, actually, if we want it to be. So if we think of success as something that allows people to engage with the memory that the intended memorial is meant to deal with, then that's one question. But if we want to think urbanistically about memorials that engage people on many different levels, that is to say in everyday life, then we have to look at a different set of memorials. And I do have something to say about Myelin, but first I think maybe the most, this is the controversial part, maybe the most successful memorial is an obvious one, and that's Peter Eisenman's Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. And it's successful not because its commemorative value brings us back to the Holocaust in some meaningful way, although it could and does, but because people use it for so many different things, and the way it ties together the Tiergarten in Berlin with the city itself, the way it creates a buffer, the way people do parkour on it, which is, of course, taken as sacrilegious by some people, but boy, people are using it. People do Tinder invites there. It's a hookup site. And that's not its intended use, but if I step back from all of this and don't worry about sacrilege, it's an incredibly successful memorial. And I know I could get in trouble for saying that, especially from people who want it just to be a Holocaust memorial. But going back to Myelin's memorial, it is, I think, in the process of becoming something other than what it once was, which was an incredibly effective, important memorial. And the evidence for that really comes from the plans over the, I don't know, maybe starting about 10 years ago, people wanted to make an interpretive center behind it, to build a berm behind it and create an interpretive center in it. And that, for me, was a kind of astounding move, because this was a monument that almost needed no interpretation for a long time. And now we have generations of people who really are so distant from the Vietnam War that it doesn't resonate for them. They don't know the story. And this happens. This is a natural process of cultural amnesia. And so if they build an interpretive center behind it with all sorts of mixed media, you know that's where everybody will stand and play. That's where kids will go. And they'll be there on their phones rather than standing at the wall. And all the sort of incredible moves that Myelin made, formal moves that place our bodies in front of names in a certain way and choreograph us through that space in a certain way, that will be diminished. I don't want to say it's lost, but it will be diminished. And the idea that somehow the monument doesn't speak for itself is incredibly important shift to note. Now, that interpretive center is not being built, as far as I can see, because they didn't get the money for it, which itself is kind of telling. But I do see a moment where every event like Vietnam will grow more distant, just like, say, monuments to the French Revolution or the Italian Revolution in Italy. They're these old guys that nobody knows anymore, and you have to look them up on Google.
Let's try to classify for a second the difference between a monument, the adjective monumental, and memorial.
Well, your question's interesting because I think there's a big difference between the word monument and the word monumental. The adjective takes it in a different direction, let's say. So both monument and memorial come from etymological sources that are the same. They have to do with monere, which has to do with memories. They both go to memory and commemoration. Monument, interestingly, shares an etymology that's slightly different also with the word monster, monstrare. It's a demonstration. It's a demonstration of things that we need to pay heed to. So monsters are there as allegories to warn us. So they have a traditional role of warning. And sometimes it's warning us of something that is horrific, and sometimes it's of an exemplum that's a virtue, let's say. So the Washington Monument is an example, a warning that great men are really important for the world, and they are decisive in the turning points of history. But monumental doesn't have to be that way. So there are monumental buildings that don't have that warning built in, and there are monumental buildings that don't have commemorative value at all necessarily. They could be given it, but they don't necessarily have it. So the monumental and the commemorative don't necessarily have to go together. But the monument, if we're talking about a monument that is made as a monument, it almost always has some commemorative value. That is to say, a standalone monument, rather than a building that is considered a monument. So the first monuments after the French Revolution is commonly considered the Bastille. The Bastille was set up self-consciously and preserved as a monument to the Revolution. It was not made that way, obviously. It was inadvertently turned into that. And that's a turning point in consciousness about what a monument is. The idea of the historic monument is invented more or less after the French Revolution, when a new self-consciousness towards the past, a new kind of past actually opened up, a new relationship to the past, and then a not yet opened up. And so the monument kind of negotiates between this new past and a not yet, the before, which is new. It's a secular before that's no longer tied to the Ancien Régime and the aristocracy and kings, and time changes. And monuments are in the middle of that change of time, as are memorials. So in my book, I don't fuss over the difference between monuments and memorials, because from a certain kind of point of view, there's not a significant difference. And this comes out in the record. It's not my invention. So for instance, when committees start thinking about where to put monuments, which is a serious part of late 19th century and early 20th century urbanism, especially in the United States within the context of the City Beautiful movement, they're considering aesthetic issues, and they're deciding whether a monument is going to be an aesthetic addition, you know, a beautiful thing, basically, in a city. And if it's not, they reject it. And in this case, public art is, it's not so different from public art. The grounds are the same. And then the maintenance of it is more or less the same. And so are issues after the fact. So one of the great 19th and early 20th century critics of art, Marianne Griswold von Rensselaer, a rare female critic in that period, had this to say. She said something like, "We all pass well-meaning nobodies, but if they make an aesthetic contribution to their little corner of the city, then we can be glad for them." And so it's really an aesthetic thing. So some old guy, some old bronze, it didn't mean anything commemoratively anymore to anybody, but it could still be a nice thing. For all the reasons that you said earlier, actually, Greg, that it could be a nice place to meet, a nice place to sit, a place to take a rest, a little bit of shadow or shade on a hot day. So monuments and memorials effectively could be, in some context, the same exact thing or treated the same way. And even they share a very blurry domain, let's say, in cities with public art as well. So I don't fuss. From the point of view of the everyday, they're not so different. From the point of view of commemoration, they're really different.
And then the second question would be around a memorial that is, I think, very real and present for all of us in our generation, which is the 9/11 memorial in New York City, which I think you could argue is a really great piece of urban design. It is also a very somber memorial, but it's not an obtrusive one. It kind of requires you to peer over the edge and grasp the tremendous impact of what happened. And then there is a giant mixed-use, you know, interpretive center planned from the start, unlike Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial, you know, on that site as well, although it is sort of tucked underground inside a building that has kind of its own vocabulary. So I guess my question would be, do you think that the 9/11 Memorial is successful, you know, based on the observations you've made of memorials all around the world?
Yeah. Now, New York, I have to confess, I've been stuck on the West Coast, partly because of the pandemic, partly because I had little kids when that was first built. So I haven't been there. But the architect of it did come through Berkeley and gave a talk, and I was part of the dinner committee that fested him afterwards. So I talked a lot with him about it. And he said that he was very attentive to the issues of the everyday, and he wanted it to be a place where people could sit and do things that were non-commemorative. And he said it was his grandmother that turned him on to that. Grandmother or mother, I can't remember. But he said his grandmother looked at an early design and said, where am I going to sit? And he had not thought of that. He was thinking of something more purely commemorative, as I remember the discussion. And it was somebody who was not an architect who said, no, we do other things at monuments, and you need to make this a civic space. And so I think that was transformative for him. At least he represented it that way. And I can see from the way it's been designed and from some of the amendments that have been made to it afterwards that it is serving people in all sorts of ways, not just in commemorative ways. I was also going to say that there's a wonderful New Yorker cover by Adrian Tomeen, I think that's how you say his name, that shows the everyday life around that memorial and pokes a little bit of fun at it, maybe unfairly, because that's just the way things go. People don't care if they're, you know, if a site is the most sacred in the world, they'll do what they want right at it if they want to. Yeah.
I'll use this as an opportunity to have a quick digression into cemeteries, which you covered there, because of course the 9/11 memorial is a site in living memory of mass death. And there is a somberness that will hang over that for any of us who lived through that day. But cemeteries sort of almost become the opposite. Like, they've become more consecrated over time versus the crowds that flocked to Greenwood Cemetery and treated them as parks and seem to inherently have, I guess what we would say today, less respect for the dead. But now that seems like a social taboo, a norm that you can't violate. I'm curious if you find any cases where that isn't in place, or could that reverse again one day? And I think about this in the context of New York, as I'm here in New York right now, where we have huge amounts of urban fabric that are just literally dark at night. Like, when you go to the approach to LaGuardia, the Queens cemeteries are just black spots in the urban void. And, you know, at least we could use that perhaps for recreation if we could overcome that social taboo. And so I'm curious, is there a productive capacity for cemeteries that they once had that we might revitalize? Or how might we start to reconceive those?
Yeah, I think there are cemeteries where people do things other than honor the dead or visit the dead. I know people jog at a cemetery nearby in Oakland here, and I've seen cemeteries become public parks in England. In London, I think there are a couple where there's some sort of statute of limitations on the dead, and we don't worry about them if they're more than a few hundred years old. But I think your question goes to something that's not really about architecture, but engages in architecture or the built environment in a kind of lateral way, which is that the history of death is really fascinating. It's another topic that I totally ignored. I mean, who in his 20s and 30s is concerned with death? Yet the history of death is this fascinating set of shifts about human mentalities, encountering the ultimate question, which is, where do I go? Where do I come from is one of them. Where do I go is another one. And how much fun can I have in between is a third one. But I was going to say, I do think that there's something happening with changes in the history of death. There was this wonderful piece from the mid-20th century, from the 1950s, by a sociologist named Jeffrey Gore, or Jeffrey with a G. And he says that death had replaced sex as the primary taboo of the 20th century, and that we talk about death in hushed tones, almost like we say cancer, and in hushed tones. And so there is a kind of shunning of death from the public sphere, whereas once death was naturalized, everyone saw people die all the time in the pre-modern world. It was a normal part of death, and you died at home. 99% of people died at home, and they were buried near their homes. And over the course of the medicalization and institutionalization of death, death is really taken out of the public sphere, taken out of sight. And I mean, there are two things to think about with this. The new cemeteries that you're talking about were dedicated cemeteries, and they were some of the only public spaces that people had before parks became plentiful. So they were lovely places where people who did not fear death but saw death as the sweet hereafter could encounter something that they saw as aesthetic and picturesque, and there was a kind of sensuality to it that I think they could deal with and relate to. And that's really ruptured by what Jeffrey Gore talks about, when death becomes something to be feared and something that's not well understood and not encountered. And dead bodies are frightening, and a Gothic sensibility is part of that. That is to say, Goth becomes sublime in the worst way. It's terrorizing. And so I think that, though, I've noticed in the early 21st century, a series of cultural, products that suggest that the death is changing again, and we're becoming a little bit more comfortable with it. So you can see it in shows like 6 Feet Under, where it seems like in the mid 20th century there never would have been a show about a family of undertakers, but suddenly death was okay. It became much more palatable and even entertaining. And you can see it in some of the macabre shows that come up, where death is humorous again, and we're able to deal with it in some way. I'm not saying that we're over that taboo. I still think that, you know, that it's difficult to encounter dead bodies and death, but I do think that there's a growing comfort with it. And with that, the cemetery could transform again into something that becomes a common space, as it was throughout Western history. It was really one of the most common spaces to encounter other people in, say, European towns before the modern era.
Actually, it's a great segue, because I was going to mention my travelogue. Greg and I were just talking before we all got signed on. I've just come back from the Czech Republic, where cemeteries, you know, from the pre-Enlightenment era or the Baroque era, or perhaps even older, play different roles, you know, in present society. The two most significant places I visited were Kutná Hora, which at one time was the largest city in Europe because of its vast wealth that came from silver mining. The main attraction there is the so-called bone church, or the ossuary, which, you know, every cemetery has. They dispose of the bones of the long deceased, who are then replaced by, you know, freshly deceased people in the same graves on the same site. Most ossuaries are not open to the public, however, but this one is. It's in the chapel. The chapel dates from the Baroque era, but then the decorations were completed in the 1870s. And I'm not sure what that says about the perception of death or anything, but it is a major tourist attraction that draws people from all over the world, to the point that they've now banned photography, because I assume that people backing into a pile of bones have caused more damage than all of the swords and sabers that dispatched the Hussites originally. So I get, you know, that was a really interesting observation. But it's also accompanied by a conventional cemetery, which is, you know, I think in the ancient European kind of configuration, they're in very tight spaces, and there isn't actually a lot of green space. They don't have that park-like aspect. Do you think that there's something lost in the deconsolidation and the removal of a cemetery to a suburban type location or a park-like setting from that high concentration? And did you look at the evolution of the way that cemeteries are organized over time as part of this?
Yes, yeah, so I did. There's a great book, by the way, by a guy named Philippe Ariès, which is called Hour of Our Death. It's a big, thick book about changes in mentalities towards how people view the dead. And there's incredible stuff on cemeteries, and pre-modern cemeteries in Europe, for instance, were just layers and layers of dead bodies. And they were always in churchyards. So they were urban, and they were the primary public space of a city. And people didn't worry about the fumes and the dead bodies. It was just part of everyday life. I don't think it was a happy place necessarily to have those dead bodies, but it is where some transactions went down. It's where speeches were made. Sometimes there were political sort of assemblies there. There were very few other public spaces in European towns, and it was the primary one. And in across the late 18th and early 19th century, death became medicalized. And this was seen as a health issue, even though dead bodies don't necessarily cause health issues unless they're diseased when they die. It was seen as a health issue, and cemeteries became part of the municipal infrastructure, and they were put outside of cities because they were seen as polluted in the literal sense, in the medical sense. And that new kind of cemetery in Europe and in England tended to be more verdant and green and open. The ones in the continent tended to be more enjambed. So the ones in Paris that I know, for instance, Père Lachaise, is enjambed. It's really tight, like the one you were describing in the Czech Republic. And so there are these different conventions that arise out of the medicalization of death and the creation of the new kind of cemetery, which is a dormitory for the dead. Literally, that's what cemetery means. And so I think that there are these different traditions that would answer your question differently, that it's hard in such an enjambed space to imagine people doing much more than having a cultural experience or a heritage experience or a tourist experience. You go to Jim Morrison's grave, for instance, or Karl Marx's grave is a big site where people go, these famous figures. And there's an everyday practice at them. People put pins in the ground in front of an author, for instance. Or, you know, there are all sorts of things that happen in front of different types of graves. And that is part of their everyday life. And so that wouldn't be affected by how tightly enjammed they are. But in fact, it might be harder to do that at some of the more open cemeteries in the United States, where concentrating people together might be harder to do, or graves might be harder to find without a map. So, yeah, this is something I have to think more about, actually. It's a good question. But I do think that one of the things that you brought up is important to note, which is that this seems to be something we need to understand through tourism and heritage. These are two like big categories of thinking that change the way we encounter the built environment from the past and alter our relationship to it. It's not very direct. We pay to go to these places now sometimes. If not directly, then by getting to them. It's one of the attractions of a place. So you went to this ossuary because it's cool, right? But before the modern era, before the rise of modern tourism, people didn't go there because it was cool. People went there to honor the dead or because they knew someone who had been buried there. So I'd love to know where that begins, where the attraction to, I don't want to call this dark tourism because it's not quite dark tourism. Going to Holocaust sites is dark tourism. But it's somewhere on the continuum between light tourism and dark tourism, let's say.
Sandy, I want to take the conversation back to urbanism, and I'm curious about, I guess, sort of what are the lessons you drew from your exhaustive study of all these? And I love how your book is filled with like pictures of monuments that are trapped on traffic islands and in medians, because I would think that these would be consecrated, so you would build cities around them, but no, you in fact show they could be totally isolated and cut off by post-war American urbanism is just like anyone else. But I want to go back to in terms of like, how can we use them to rethink and reconnect urban fabric? So I lived in Brooklyn Heights for a while, and there the de Blasio administration in 2014 like called for a plan to connect the Brooklyn waterfront, and WXY, the architecture practice, basically leveraged the Brooklyn War Memorial and the sort of necklace of parks through there, which are playing fields for children and daycare, these great spaces, to sort of connect that. And I'm wondering, are there opportunities or how should we start to think about them as like tools in the planner or placemaker's toolkits as a way to sort of use their, I was going to say not exalted status, but like nominally exalted status as a way to like leverage this? Because they are often by historical standards, those centers of parks and piazzas, which I also, you know, you cover a bit as sort of like why they become turned on is because they actually have spaces where people can gather as well. But anyway, I guess going back to the question I asked earlier about the future of these places, like how can we be sort of instrumentalist about it? Like how can we use them to build better places? Whatever that means.
Right, yeah. So I think what we'd want to do is do a survey of memorials and monuments that function really well urbanistically in the way that we talked about Eisenman's. And we'd have to divest ourselves from the idea that somehow they're going to be purely commemorative and understand that they'll have these many different uses and that they'll follow maybe calendrically or temporally different types of usage throughout the year with different weather patterns and things like that. I think we'd want to design the way we would design a good civic space and understand that a monument or a memorial will have a certain gravitational pull at certain moments, and it might be repulsive in certain moments too. And so by studying a series of examples that function vividly, I think we could learn some lessons. I think each new space, though, would require rethinking, of course. You can't repeat Eisenman's Holocaust Memorial somewhere else and hope that it would work. People have tried, for instance, to repeat Maya Lin's wall elsewhere, and it doesn't work nearly like Maya Lin's wall. So its formal properties have limits. Its spatial properties have limits. But I think a sensitive designer can work with that. I like your example because I do think that it shows something that's really common in the history of architecture and urbanism, which is that monuments have been swept up into much larger processes of urban planning. and they're not treated necessarily as sacred objects. They take a backseat often to urban planning, but when they need to show up as monuments, if the designer's been sensitive to it, they still can. I think Hyde Park Corner is a good example of that, which is a kind of menagerie of war memorials. It's a site of British war heritage. And all of those memorials can be turned on still. They all function if they need to at certain moments. And they also function as heritage. They function as tourist sites. They function as shade. They're part of a throughway for people. People ride bikes through the whole thing. It is sacred and it is completely not sacred at the same time sometimes, like at the exact same time. But it can also, as I said at the very beginning of the show, it can flit back and forth. And in some ways, we could play with the very title of your series. That is to say, these things get frozen and unfrozen. That's another metaphor that we could be using for this. So Goethe's in the room, if you will, you know.
He's never left.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you for that recognition. Sticking with the idea of the switched on memorial for a second, I want to get to the idea of destruction of monuments and memorials as a way of switching them on, in the sense that people weren't really paying much attention to them until someone defaced them or destroyed them as a political statement. I'm thinking of everything from the Marian columns in the Czech Republic and other parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which would go down and up depending on who was in charge. They just put the one in Prague back. Of course, the Confederate statues that are now so controversial and being taken down throughout the United States. And then even just weird, you know, kind of American roadside attractions type stuff, like the Georgia Guidestones were recently dynamited by an unknown party. What do you think it means how can a memorial be switched on when it's present and in its intended state? And then what does it mean that sometimes they don't get switched on until we blow them up?
Yeah, so I think this starts with the French Revolution. And I should really back up and say that when my book was peer reviewed, both reviewers said the events starting in 2017-18 with Confederate memorials was a game changer, and that I didn't acknowledge it enough, and that I really had to rewrite the book with that in mind. And I sat with that criticism for a while. Is it really a game changer was the question I was asking, and I wasn't so sure it was. So the long view, going back to the French Revolution, is that monuments get destroyed all the time. Going back to the Roman Republic, for instance, they were constantly cleared out of the forum when a new political regime came in. So they're part of the language of power, and power will annihilate previous powers partly by annihilating the symbols of those powers, even if those symbols are used for some other purpose. So I'm not so sure that the recent events having to do with Confederate monuments is a game changer any more than any other wave of iconoclasm. I think it's important. I'm not trying to diminish it, because I think it is important, and it could be a signal about the deeply contentious nature of race in our culture right now. And we should pay attention to it. But from the point of view of my book, it's not. It's one more episode. And what does it mean? Your question's a little different from that, though. What does it mean that a monument that can be so present or invisible then becomes more present, sometimes really alive, when it gets destroyed? I don't know. Maybe the Robert E. Lee Memorial in Richmond is the place to start looking at this, where it really wasn't. It's very large, by the way. It's really hard to ignore. It's the largest in that little array of monuments in the triangle in Richmond. And yet it really is easy to ignore. Just another guy on a horse on a giant pedestal. And I think it became more lively with Black Lives Matter. It started to be offensive in a new way, or maybe it had always been offensive to some people, but now they had a platform to talk about it. I think that history needs to be reconstructed to see how invisible it was, to see how silent it had become, to see how irksome it was for some people and not for others. I'd like to find evidence of all that to really reconstruct that history before making a judgment about it. But in any case, it became very, very, very visible. But what made it visible was those folks who started putting graffiti on it and putting Black Lives Matter slogans on it, and then in that most captivating way, projecting images of important Black leaders onto it. And those are such arresting images. They're, once you see them, you can't unsee them. And it, I think they're more iconic than the statue probably ever was. So even though the monument is now gone, I think those images are incredibly iconic, at least for anyone who lived through it. Then again, we'll have another generation come through that will only know it through the telling. And I think it'll be less poignant for them. At the same time, there's wrinkles to that story that are just fascinating. So there was a piece in the Washington Post recently that they couldn't find a contractor to take down the base, and no white contractor would touch it, and they had to get a Black contractor to do it. That is just astounding to me. I'm not even sure what that means. It's just, I have a visceral reaction rather than an intellectual reaction to that. I can't make sense of it, partly because I think my emotions get in the way. It just pisses me off that people can't, that there's not a single contractor within the Richmond region that would take that down who was white. That is just astounding to me. So yeah, it's still meaningful, right? Even though it's been, even though the statue's gone, even though it has gone through these different iterations, even though there's a plan to replace it, it is still meaningful, and it will always be the Robert E. Lee Monument, no matter what is there. It will still have that echo, that ghost to it. People will never forget that. Even if they're told it, even my grandkids will be able to reconstruct that, I think.
Well, in a similar vein to that, I'm curious, you know, in the United States, at least, it seems like the only memorials and monuments that get built are, of course, the epic variety. We talked about the 9/11 memorial. We talk about the mall in Washington, you know, where there's huge federal budgets for these kinds of things. But the idea, and perhaps it happens all the time, and I simply haven't noticed, of building new statuary, of creating new public plazas, doesn't seem to exist. And I'm curious, is there any process for this? Because the thing that I learned from the takedowns of Confederate monuments, of course, was that the Daughters of the Confederacy was, of course, a grassroots or AstroTurf funding group that set these all up. And I'm curious, can we come back to that? How do we fund more memorials or monuments or create these things? And I bring this up because there was a while, about a decade ago, there was the idea of Kickstarter urbanism, which also led to the concept of Brickstarter, the idea that you could have some sort of bottom-up funding mechanisms for these kinds of things. We saw tactical urbanism. Like, are there tactical urbanist monuments? Should we go do guerrilla monuments in our neighborhoods kind of thing? I'm curious, again, I know I've asked this about four times, but like in the sense of the future of these things, in a place that is scared of death and refuses to confront the past most of the time and only looks to the future, what is the future of the past in that regard?
Yeah, well, so the past is a funny little thing because we disdain it and also obsess over it at the same time. I do think that there are lots of monuments being built, and there is a big clamor, for instance, for monuments to women to level the playing field, because there are plenty of dead white men, as they're often referred to, but very few women in the public sphere. I mean, really a paltry number. And there are plenty of women who could be memorialized or replace those often forgotten guys or reprehensible guys. So, you know, what your question makes me think of, Greg, is that there are these waves of memorial mania where new memorials are made in abundance, and then there's memorial exhaustion or statue phobia. Or in German, they call it Denkmalkritik, critique of the monuments. And I don't know what moment we're in right now. It could be that we're kind of in both. We're such a pluralistic society that it could be some people are clamoring for more and getting them built, and others are not. Others are against them. You will see people say no more monuments. Trevor Noah said, no more statues, folks. I mean, literally, he said, we don't need any more statues. Let's get rid of them all. And many people want to get rid of them all. I think that would be a loss, not for history, not for memory, but because they play an everyday role. They're signposts. They're landmarks. They do something. I don't care so much. This is my personal opinion, as a historian. This is not a removed, distant opinion. I don't care what they're doing so much in terms of commemoration. I care that they're civic objects that are doing interesting things. And could they be replaced with something else? I think not, because they're doing something different than, say, a light post is doing or a fire hydrant is doing. They're sheltering activity, and they're creating a gravitational pool, as I said earlier. One of the sort of really influential writings that I looked at talks about a kind of metaphorical roof that memorials create over themselves, and they do it differently than other civic objects do. And this gets to your earlier question about what's the future. How can we use them in some way? And I think thinking about the metaphorical roof that they provide is one way of thinking about that. What kind of roof do we want? What are we sheltering here, even if it's a temporary shelter? So that's one of my thoughts. And there are tactical urban monuments. I've seen them here in California. I don't know if they're as common elsewhere. But you'll see them. For instance, there are those white bikes that appear every once in a while. And they're really startling when you see one. You're instantly put in mind that something horrific happened, somebody died, and you're on alert. And then you look at the urbanism, look at the urbanism in that place, and I think, what's dangerous here? So it changes the way I see that site and the way I move through it. And I'm often on a bike when I'm doing that too, because I, as you can see, I have my bike right there. So I do think that there are these monuments, and there are several other that comes to mind. They're too kind of specific for me to describe on air. I'd need to show them in order to really make sense of them for anybody listening. So I do think that that's happening. I think that those are more quiet gestures than monumental ones. So these, in this case, this gets back to your question, Daniel. These are more memorials than monuments, I would say, or their monumental quality is very diminished and their memorial quality is big. But yeah, I do think the age of epic monuments is highly contested now, and has been for a long time. Really, since World War II, there was a kind of memorial exhaustion. It's a lovely book by a guy named Paul Fussell, not about memorials, but about World War II, and the literary World War II. And he said, why is it that we have so many amazing poets and writers who come out of World War I who describe the World War I experience, and after World War II, it's relatively quiet? There's crickets. And it's the reticence to talk about World War II, same generation having engaged in two world wars, led to a kind of reticence and a quietness about that experience. And the same thing is shown in the memorial landscape. There are just very few, there were anyway, in the wake of World War II, very few war memorials just to World War II. Most of them were, in fact, additive. You'd put names onto an older memorial, either a Civil War or World War I memorial. And so there's a quietness about World War II. And we only come back to a kind of real interest in memorials after Maya Lin. I think that's one of the big pivots, in fact. And not always for good. Like the World War II Memorial, the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. is, I think, a really terrible failed memorial from almost any point of view, including the everyday life. So people don't put peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in front of the names at the World War II Memorial, as far as I know, but they do continue to do that in Vietnam. Which means it's alive to people as they visit it. So yeah, that doesn't quite get to your question, but there are these forces that are kind of bigger than memorials that have to do with death and war and history and memorial mania and worries over even utilitarian worries. Like, why are we putting all this money into memorials when we could be doing something else? So that after World War I and especially after World War II, there are civic buildings that get built. So when I was a kid growing up in Philadelphia, I went to see the Philadelphia Phillies in Veterans Memorial Stadium. It was a Vietnam War memorial. And I don't know that anybody really thought about it after a decade or two that it was a memorial, but it was. And then when it came down, nobody noted that they were destroying a memorial. I wrote an op-ed to the Philadelphia Inquirer that didn't get published saying, hey, let's take a moment just to acknowledge that this is happening. Not because I cared about it as a memorial, but because I cared that nobody noticed it. I like the fact that it's not being noticed is interesting to me.
You took us to a lot of places in this book, many of which, well, I didn't really know much about, but it was a somewhat expected arc in the sense that we went through Enlightenment Europe, we went through 19th century America, 19th century Britain, where there was a sort of, as you say, statue mania underway. One place I did not expect to get taken was the Rick Caruso development, The Grove, in Los Angeles, because it does feature a statue as a centerpiece in its simulacra of the, you know, imagined 1950s ideal town square. Why did you include that example in the book, and does that even count as a memorial?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So one of my real interests is what's been happening over maybe a couple decades, where bronze is being reused and being kind of reappropriated as a material of dignity. And you'll see it at places you don't expect. At subdivisions, in malls, you'll see bronze statues. And that did not happen when I was a kid. That's a change. And I was interested in how this new material, this old material, I should say, and this old set of forms, statues, are being brought into a new context. And some of them are behaving exactly like memorials or monuments. So I think that that statue at the Grove is behaving exactly like a memorial in a public square in a European town. That's the behavior it's imitating. I don't think it's a monument or a memorial, although it pretends to be, but I think it's behaving like one. It was set up as one, and it's part of the falsification of that whole complex. And I don't say falsification with moral, disopprobrium. It's really okay. It's fine. If people want to meet at that ugly statue, they can. And if it's working, it doesn't matter if it's ugly or fake. Because from an urban point of view, it's good. And I think the Grove, although I have distaste for it, actually works fairly well. I think it's elitist for the most part, but the last time I went there, it didn't seem that way. It seemed pretty multicultural. It didn't seem like it was purely elite. So I think I'm interested in this. I'm interested in these monuments to fake things, and they mingle all the time with real monuments. So for instance, one of the sites that just had me really interested in the topic and wanting to write about it, aside from the book, is the Texas State Capitol grounds, where you'll find actual memorials to almost every war. And then you'll find a miniature Statue of Liberty, which is a monument to the Boy Scouts, as if the Boy Scouts need a monument. And it's not really a monument, even though it's behaving like a monument. And that's from the 50s, actually. So this is maybe the earliest moment where something like this starts to happen, where the language of monuments is being appropriated for some other purpose and we're not quite sure why. And then you'll also see the Ten Commandments, and then you'll also see a set of bronzes of kids playing in the grass next to a sign that says, "Do not play with the statues," which is exactly what kids would want to do, right? So multiple types of memorial-like or monument-like installations or interventions that are mingled together, that are borrowing from one another, borrowing from the language and situation that every other one is expressing, and yet they're doing different things. And that, to me, goes to the blur that's interesting to me, the blur between public art, all sorts of types of interventions like the Ten Commandments or a Boy Scout monument in scare quotes, and so on, and real monuments and real memorials. And that blur, to me, is a topic unto itself that's interesting.
Thank you so much for joining the podcast today. This is super interesting. This is Andrew Shankin. The book is called The Everyday Life of Memorials.
Thank you, too. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Trying to make some sense of